All right, beloved, let's turn to the book of Proverbs. Chapter 1 will do. That's where we're going to be tonight. I've decided we're going to try to take various topics. I was really tortured about how to do this. Would maybe just take some of my favorite proverbs and just preach on them, or I want to kind of really help us to understand what's in this book. I think that's more important at this point. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the emphasis on hearing, having an ear to hear. We'll do that this week and then the next week and see what the ramifications are for listening and not listening. And they are huge. About 300 years before the Lord Jesus walked the earth, there was a Greek philosopher, and his name was Zeno. Z-E-N-O. Anybody ever hear of Zeno? Zeno made a statement that I'm quite sure that he never would have dreamed would become what it became, namely a powerful weapon in the arsenal of parents, and really universally. Parents all over the world have used this one quote by this philosopher. I'm sure that there's at least one person in here tonight, and probably a whole lot more, that your parents quoted Zeno to you. And this would happen especially if you were very talkative and very noisy, and your mouth was just constantly going, right? And here's what Zeno said: the reason we have two ears and one mouth so that you can listen more and talk less. And that's been repeated now for 2,000 years. Well, 1,700 years anyway. 2,300 years, actually, all over the world. Now, you know, I got to thinking about what Zeno said, and then I got to thinking about, was ancient Greece as noisy as our world is today? Well, it might have been. I'm not so sure, though. I mean, Zeno, you know, I think if Zeno was alive to hear the noise today, that he might have covered his ears. You know, what I mean is the Greeks did not have the necessities of life that we have, like radio and portable and stationary televisions, amplified rock music. You know, that stuff goes up to 120 decibels. If you go to a Seahawks game or you watch it on TV, they have these little meters that say how loud the 12s get, you know, how loud it gets in the stadium. And they're always trying to break 100, you know. But a typical rock song in a rock concert is 120 decibels. Telephones, constantly got telephones and earbuds in our ears, right? Pesky solicitation calls, movies, DVD players, Netflix, iPods, all of the devices that have invaded our modern life. And Zeno didn't know anything about that. And Zeno never heard in his life a jet plane, which, by the way, is way louder than a rock concert. A jet plane, if you were standing right now, that's why those guys down on the tarmac wear earplugs. Earphones, because that's 140 decibels. A power lawnmower, a gas-propelled lawnmower with a good engine in it, 100 decibels. Right. Zeno never, ever stopped his car, only to be pulled up to alongside by another vehicle with the ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And it's so powerful that you can actually feel my little soul rocks, you know, when that happens. You can actually feel the pounding, like the earth shaking when these people pull up next to you. Zeno never spent the night in a motel room with tissue paper walls to separate him from the room next door to him where the TV was obviously being ignored by the guest who had to have been deaf, you see. So I don't know what Zeno would think today about his statement. Listen more and talk less. You know, right? I mean, he might have turned into a Scrooge about it. Bah, humbug. But there's times when about the only way that you can protect your sanity, not to mention your hearing, is to open your mouth and to say something, even if it's nothing more than a primal scream. Now, I'm kind of being facetious and cute, but there's a tragedy of life, particularly of modern life, I think, that is pretty great. And it isn't that people invade our privacy or that they get on our nerves, that they help destroy our delicate hearing apparatus, which actually it does. That kind of noise does destroy your hearing. One of the great tragedies of modern times, besides our innate depravity, is that there's so much noise, peripheral noise all around us, on the outside, that people cannot hear the things that they really need to hear to affect their inside. Because God, I believe, is trying to get through to every person on the face of the earth, and he's at least trying to reach them with the voice of wisdom. But all people can hear are confused communications, this clutter, foolish voices that lead them further and further and further away from the truth. You can see that happening in our civilization. The godlessness is just compounding exponentially. And even without our modern electronic noisemakers, I think there was a similar situation in ancient Israel when Solomon actually wrote the book of Proverbs, because there's really, as he said in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, God was speaking to people in Solomon's day, but the best I can tell, there weren't a whole bunch that listened. Now, let me just review with you ever so quickly before we begin tonight the outline of Proverbs, all right? Just the bare bone shell of it. Remember, the first nine chapters, and I call them two women, and I'm calling them women because the two major words, wisdom and folly, are both have a feminine gender in the original Hebrew. So I'm calling them ladies, okay? Wisdom and folly. And they're personified, okay? And they are both vying for attention. They want to get the attention of the whole world. Both of them do. And they're screaming out to civilization and to humanity all over the world. So what I want to do this tonight, we'll just introduce it tonight, and then next week, is we want to look at wisdom's calls. Just take wisdom first. Okay, and then when we get done with wisdom, next week we'll move to folly's calls and see what these two ladies are shouting about. Okay, now wisdom calls to three different things, and we'll probably only get through one tonight. First of all, she calls to salvation. She calls to get saved. Now, you're not going to find the gospel per se in Proverbs chapter 1, but that really is the call, particularly in verses 8 through 33, okay? Now, that is one long paragraph. We don't have the short, pithy statements yet like we will in the second half of the book. But what's recorded between verses 8 and 33 are these three voices, all right, that as we read it, you can hear these voices calling out to you if you really tune in. All right, so let's go through them. First of all, there's a voice of instruction. It's very didactic. Didactic means teaching. There's teaching going on. All right, so let's just take a peek, for example, at verse 8. My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Why? I mean, isn't that what kids say? Why? Well, for, that's a because, they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head and chains about thy neck. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. So we have here the voice of a godly father, all right, and he's urging his son to listen to that lady called wisdom. And you pay close attention to what she says, because if you obey her, it's going to be well with you. Now, I need to point out that it's not just dad who's being singled out here. Both father and mother have been involved in the teaching of the boy. Okay? And you can see that in verse 8. Forsake not the law of thy mother. She has a law. All right? And probably she spent a lot more time with the boy than even dad did, because dad's out working. Okay? By the way, that phrase that you see there, my son, appears 41 times in Proverbs. All right. But the influence of mom is not ignored. I mean, it's vital and it's there. In fact, she's all the way through Proverbs. I won't take the time to read all the verses. It'll take too long. But yeah, she's everywhere. Like chapter 4, verse 3. For I was my father's son, tender and only beloved in the sight of my mother. And she's mentioned all the way through, so it's not just a one-parent show, okay? So both father and mother, they work as a team, and they've been involved in warning their son, particularly as he's growing up as a youth. Don't forsake what we're telling you. We've lived life. You haven't yet. Listen to us. We've been. You can avoid the mistakes that we've made. We can share some very important things with you. And even if your parents are turds, I mean, they still have an experience of living that they can share some things with you. All right. The ones being spoken of here, they have obeyed the instructions of Moses. I mean, every Jew knew the Shema, right? You know what the Shema is? Deuteronomy 6. For verses 6 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord. And he says, these words that I'm commanding you, I want them in your heart. I don't want them in one ear and out the other. I want them in your heart. And then I want you to teach them diligently to your children. You're to talk about them in your house when you're sitting around, when you're walking by the way, when you're lying down, once you get up. In other words, no matter what position, when you're supine or upright or kind of in the recliner or whatever, no matter what you're doing, you're talking about God. And bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. That's where the Jews literally, they took that verse literally, and you have the phylacteries and the head thing that the Jews wore. And write them on the posts of thy house and on thy gates. All right, so that was expected of a Jewish family who were expected by God to faithfully teach their children the things of the Lord. Now, the million-dollar question, though, was what are the children going to do with the instruction? That's the million-dollar question. The parents' desire is that the kids obey what they've learned so that the truth of God will become a lovely ornament to beautify their lives. Isn't that the metaphor that's being used there in verse 9? Okay, it's like a crown on a king. An amazing way to talk about wisdom. The gaining of wisdom is like wearing that 2.5-pound crown that Queen Elizabeth said would break her neck at the coronation if she didn't raise her notes up to her. She didn't dare bend her neck. Right? Or the necklace of a queen. You know, and Paul was aware of this language, and that's why he would use, like, for example, in Titus 2 and verse 10, he encourages that young man to adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in all things. Put on, you take wisdom, doctrine, whatever you want to call it, and you put it on like clothing. And it's a beautiful thing to behold. It makes Christian theology and the things of the Lord beautiful to others, especially if that information is accompanied by a godly life, a real life. It's like when Peter exhorted Christian wives, your husband is completely lost. He's a total zero. But instead of trying to impress him with an artificial kind of a beauty and worldly glamour, he says to these ladies in 1 Peter, let's see if I can find it quick enough here. 1 Peter chapter 3, don't worry about that kind of stuff, he says. 1 Peter 3 and verse 3. He talks about their adorning. He says, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting of hair, you know. Don't be worried about you're still worried about the outside, the wearing of gold, the putting on of apparel. You shouldn't be spending your whole life in the mall and trying to impress people that way. Let it be the hidden man of the heart and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which in the sight of God is of great price. For after this manner in old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. Then it starts talking about Sarah there and how that and the effect that that can have on even an ungodly man. You see, that's wisdom. And so instruction is screaming out. Here's a dad talking to his son. And then in verses 15 to 19, the father's telling his son how to avoid. Here's the one thing that I want to share with you that caused me to stumble. You have got to be able to deal with temptation. All right. Now notice what he says. First, he says, you need to check what path you're going to be on. All right. Do not walk with the wrong crowd. And it sounds, again, it's just like Psalm 1 and verse 1. All right. It's just like 2 Corinthians 6. Come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord. If you're walking with the wrong crowd, you will end up doing the wrong things. That's absolutely a guarantee. And somebody says, no, not me. Yeah, you. Yeah, you're going to do the wrong things. And you can see it. Verse 15, my son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path. Why, dad? For their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. And you're going to be right with them. And then second, notice what he says in verse 17. Don't play with temptation. Because temptation is the most subtle trap there is. It's a giant trap. See that in verse 17? Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. Now birds are smarter than most people are because they don't just take bait when they can plainly see. The birds can see the traps and they avoid them. A person, a human being, ought to be smarter than a bird, but evidently they're not too smart. And James talks about the same thing. James' picture in James chapter 1 is like bait. The devil has bait. He uses bait. In fact, he doesn't talk about it, but he uses hunting and fishing metaphors. That he's getting his imagery from that world, hunting and fishing. And the devil tells you that you can take the bait and you're able to avoid the consequences. And that's seldom ever true. Seldom is that ever true. James 1:14. Lust gives birth to sin, and sin leads to death. Because you took the bait. And then thirdly, when you disobey God by inevitably harming someone else, you only really wind up harming yourself. You think you're doing damage to somebody else. Look at verse 18. And they lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone that is greedy of gain, which taketh away the life of the owners thereof. All right. I mean, you're free to take what you want from life, but eventually you've got to pay for it. There's really nothing that's ever really totally free except God's salvation. And the price that you pay is always higher than the value that you think you've gained or that you actually have gained. You end up always sacrificing the permanent on the altar of the immediate. You trade that which is permanent for that which is temporary, which is always a bad investment. Always a bad investment. Okay? So these voices are speaking. You have the one here, the voice of instruction. And then there's the voice of temptation. Temptation actually has its own voice in verses 11 through 14. All right, you see that? No, let's look at that. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause, let's swallow them up. Alive is the grave and whole as those that go down to the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in thy lot among us. Let's all have one purse. Yeah. Right? We've all seen this in action. You've seen it in plays and movies and other things. Now, friends, here's what a young kid needs to learn, and here's what we all need to remember every day of our life. Anybody that makes it easy for you to disobey God, regardless of what they say and how they act, listen, is not your friend. Did you hear me? Because hardly anybody understands this. Anybody that makes it easy for you to sin, easier for you to sin, that person is not your friend. The offer that they made, I mean, it sounds exciting. I mean, what an amazing thing to try to pull off. It only leads to disaster. It's very tragic that a group of people would actually find enjoyment in doing the kind of evil that's done. And how stupid, foolish of these people to think that their loot is what's going to really satisfy their lives. They have completely rejected the eternal treasures that wisdom can afford them. And all throughout Proverbs, like chapter 16, verse 16, better to get wisdom than gold. How many believe that? I don't know anybody that believes that. Better to get understanding than silver. Over in chapter 3, beginning in verse 14, it's talking about wisdom. It says, the merchandise of it, wisdom, is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. She's more precious than rubies, and all the things thou canst desire are not to be compared unto her. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. Wisdom has those things. That's what wisdom can do for you. And not the cheap trinkets of the world. You know, you wind up losing your soul in the bargain. You really do. And then there's the voice of salvation, which is a much longer paragraph. In verse 20, goes all the way down to verse 33 there in Proverbs 1, the end of the chapter. Now, let me ask you, how does wisdom speak? Does wisdom speak very timidly? Very sheepishly? Is that the way wisdom speaks? Not in the book of Proverbs, right? Wisdom speaks with a booming, powerful, megaphone voice that everyone can hear. And it does it in many different ways. It does it through creation. I've always found it amazing as I've gone through Romans. In Romans 10, of all places, Paul, again, he quotes Psalm 19. Psalm 19 is the penultimate psalm for creation, especially the first four verses. And Paul actually quotes the fourth verse there. He says, their sound, what sound? The sound of creation, it has its own sound, went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world. You mean creation talks? Yeah, it speaks, it screams to men that God exists. And not only creation, but men's conscience. Men's conscience bears witness that there's a God because they're made in God's image. And Paul says in the first chapter, verse 19, that what may be known of God is manifest in them. He's talking about the lost world there. For God hath shown it to them. Everybody, there are no real atheists. They can say they're atheists, but they're not. They're made in God's image. They know there's something beyond this. Now, our job is to proclaim who this God is that they already know. And we do that by giving the gospel so that everybody can hear and that hopefully people can be saved. And they always have been for 2,000 years now. Right? We actually, when our job as a church, friends, and as individuals is to be just like wisdom. Wisdom is screaming out there. And we're not going to scream and raise our voice, but we need to be uncompromising like wisdom is. Wisdom doesn't compromise. There's no gray with wisdom. All right, now, let me just ask four questions, and I'm raising them all from the text, okay? Question number one, where does wisdom speak? Where does wisdom speak? And what you'll find in Proverbs is it's always in a big crowd. It's in the crowded streets. It's in the most public of places. It's wherever busy people gather together to take care of daily things of life. Wherever there's people. And the message of God's truth is made for the marketplace, not the ivory tower. All right? We need to share it. Notice verse 21 of Proverbs. She crieth in the chief place of concourse, where the most people are, in the openings of the gates. In the city she uttereth her words. Right? It speaks where there's people. The city gates where the leaders are. That's where Lot went. He wound up being he wound up hanging out there and became one of them, where the official businesses were transacted. So no matter where people are, that's where wisdom speaks, and they all need to hear it. All right? So where does wisdom speak? Wherever there's people. All right, then to whom does wisdom speak? And what verse 22 does is it names three classes of sinners. Okay, notice verse 22. First you have the simple ones. How long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And then the scorner. All right, those are the mockers. Those are the nasty, they're nasty dudes, those people. And the scorners delight in their scorning. They get a kick out of it. And then thirdly, fools. And all it says about them there is that they hate knowledge. Scorners, so you have simple ones, scorners, and fools. Okay? The simple ones are naive people. They'll believe anything. It don't matter what you tell them, they'll believe it. They believe it instantly. They don't check it. They're not Bereans. They don't check anything. They just believe it. And they fall for everything. They examine nothing. They're gullible and easily led astray. There's lots of those kinds of people. There's also a lot of scorners. The scorner, besides being a disgusting person, they're scorners because they think they have the corner on life. They think that they are the ones in the know. Okay. In fact, Solomon says that. Because of verse 24, because I have called and ye refused, I've stretched out my hand and no man regarded. Because they know everything. They don't need to be taught. That's why they're scorners. They laugh at the things that are really important. So the simple guy, the first guy of verse 22, he's got a blank stare. You know, there's nobody's home. He's just a happy idiot. But the scorner, he has a scowl on his face. You got two different facial expressions there in these guys. A sneer on the scorner. And then a fool, that's actually, we'll see later on, there's five different kinds of fools in the Bible. But in general, a fool is a person who's ignorant of truth because they're dull or they're stubborn or both. And the fool doesn't mean you're stupid, all right? The problem is not a low IQ or a poor education. That's not the issue, all right? The problem is a lack of a spiritual desire to just want to know God, to have the wisdom to know that God's way is the best way. Fools love their foolishness without ever knowing how foolish they really are. And so the outlook of a fool is completely materialistic. A fool is any humanist. Anybody that only my flesh, my life, anything I can see, touch, smell, feel, and hear. Anything that's sensual. And that's all I care about. That's a fool. They hate knowledge. They have no interest consequentially in eternal things. And we'll talk about the fool much later on. All right, now question number three. What are the questions? Where does wisdom speak? In the places where people are. To whom does wisdom speak? To the three kinds of sinners mentioned in verse 22. Question number three, what does wisdom say to these people? Well, first, in verse 22, what do you call verse 22? Wisdom is, she's bringing an indictment against them. All right, she's asking how long, that's the question. How long do you plan to keep yourself in this dangerous position? How long? I've spoken to you, wisdom has time and time and time again. You will not listen, and that's going to make your judgment all the more severe. He that stiffeneth his neck, being often reproved, shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. All right, so there's an indictment. And then there's an invitation. Turn from your evil ways and receive wisdom. All right, and we're talking about salvation. I mean, because Christ is wisdom incarnate. Verse 23, turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I'll make known my words unto you. What an offer. What an invitation that is. It's really, verse 23 is a call to repentance and to faith. Wisdom says, I can change your heart. All right, I can make you like God in your character and in your demeanor. All right, question number four. How do those three sinners of verse 22, the simple, the scorner, and the fool, how do they respond to wisdom? Well, they refuse to obey. They won't take hold of wisdom's outstretched hand. Right? That's the picture there, right in the text. Wisdom sticking her hand out, take my hand. They won't do it. They won't do it. They're sinking quicker, more surely in the quicksand. They won't even reach up and take it. They laugh at her warnings. They mock her words. You see in verse 26 the word also. All right. Go back up to verse 24. Because I've called and ye refused, I've stretched out my hand and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught all my counsel and would none of my reproof. I also. Now that word also is a bit, I think that that's the most important word in verse 26. In other words, because you laughed at wisdom, one day wisdom is going to laugh at you. In keeping with Psalm 2. Because you mocked at wisdom, she's going to mock you. So what wisdom sees is a storm of judgment coming. And it's going to be nasty. It's going to bring distress and anguish. If you reject this invitation that can lead to a quality of life that you have never even imagined, then you got no one to blame but yourself. And when judgment arrives, sinners are going to call upon the Lord, but it'll be too late. That's what always happens. That's what it'll happen in the tribulation. It'll be too late. It happens even today in this life. That's why you got to love that verse in Isaiah 55, right? Verse 6. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. In other words, you can put all it all together. You will reap what you have sown. And the missing element in your life will be this lack of wisdom. That'll be the missing element. Look at verse 31. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way, and be filled with their own devices. What you gave yourself to is what you'll reap. You turned your ears away from hearing the truth, verse 32. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them. You don't want to listen? Your refusal to listen is what will kill you. And the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. You'll be strangled by your own pursuit of perishable things. But in contrast to the judgment promised to these unbelievers, wisdom makes amazing promises. Security, peace. How important are those things? How many people want those things? They just don't want the Lord. See, look at the promise that wisdom makes in verse 33. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil. In other words, you're just going to have peace in your heart. Everything's going to be right. No matter what your circumstance, everything's okay because things are right between you and God because you have a supernatural wisdom that everybody else rejected. So everything's okay, regardless if everything's not okay. Everything may not be okay on the outside, but it is here. Wisdom, amazingly important element of life. Amazingly important. Unbelievably important. All right, so in chapter 1, verses 8 through 33, you have wisdom's call to salvation. And wisdom personified is the Lord Jesus Christ. He's not mentioned verbatim in chapter 1, but that's really what, I mean, if we're talking to somebody today, that's what we're talking about. You got to get saved. The wisdom of God died for you. You have to get saved. All right? And then what we'll do next week is look at chapters 8 and 9 and just pull some things out of there. And there's two elements in chapters 8 and 9. Wisdom's call to true wealth. Everybody wants to be wealthy, right? But wisdom has a true wealth that it can bestow. And then secondly, wisdom can give you real life. Real life. Real wealth, real life can only be found in the wisdom of God. That's chapters 8 and 9. So we'll go over that next week.